together. And this will be Dr. Wan's last lecture as we go through the day. That will be the case. So once again, I give a very warm welcome to Dr. Wan.
My favorite pegs, I don't think I'll trade these in for the money, is Darth Sagan eats Tyson chicken on toast. Another one is you burnt your toast in the toaster, blame it on global warming. We have to bow our heads before the Lord. You know, the Bible says it's vain to go to bed early or to rise early. The Lord is the one who gives his beloved sleep. So I hope you had good sleep last night. Let's pray. Please give us concentration, Lord. We thank you for bringing us here, and we ask for your great blessing upon us now and the rest of the day. We thank you also for your kindness in bringing us here and giving us health and giving us the strength to benefit from all that you have provided. In Jesus' name, amen. All right. So this morning I'm going to be talking to you about something entirely different. And finally we're at a point where I think I can speak to you about space physics, space science. This is really the way I would love to teach to my students. First, you need to understand the background, if you like, of physics and science and why it's not the almighty oracle that so many people make it out to be. And then you can sort of teach the things that we've learned and the ways that we examine the world that God has given us. So when I speak about atoms and things like that now, you are no longer philosophically naive, let's say. You can come to these things, and when I say certain things, you can go, aha, and mm, and you know kind of the background of what I'm talking about. You won't just say, oh, okay, he believes in little hard balls and he believes in this and that. I may, but not necessarily. You need to take some of the tools that you've learned and apply them now and in the future when you hear people speaking about science. So, this is just a pure space physics lecture. What is space physics? What is space science? The Bible tells us in one place that the wind blows where it wills. Something very fascinating. And one of the wonderful things about physics is that unlike many people's perception, it takes tremendous creativity and imagination. Somebody with a poor imagination is not really able to be good at physics. That's why you often find that physicists are highly skilled in things like music. Not me, but many others. There's one physicist who goes to the 4AGU meeting. I told you where there are tens of thousands of scientists. His name is Vytenis Vasilounis from Europe, and he's a concert-level organist, and he plays the organ every time he comes there. And he's one of the top physicists in that area in the world. And that's not unusual, because you get these creative individuals going into the sciences, into physics in particular. You know that music's highly mathematical, so perhaps it shouldn't be too much of a surprise to you. But people have been conditioned to fear the math and fear the physics and all of that, but everybody loves it at a certain point. You did, once upon a time, before you were two, maybe. And somehow we lose that because we gain a fear of other things. But let's just take a look then into the space physics. What exactly is that? That is the study of space. Anything from 80 kilometers up. What's that? About 60 miles up above our heads. Into space, all the way to the sun, other planets beyond. That is space physics. So we are in a solar system made up of 8 planets and one star, which is the sun. This is a picture showing us an artist's rendition of what that looks like. And the distance between the Earth and the sun, which is the most significant star in our context, is huge. That much in terms of meters. We we're the third planet from the sun, and you can see in this picture I've adopted the heliocentric picture of the world in which we live. That means sun-centered. You know, of course, that there was a big argument in the Roman Church about whether the Earth is the center or the sun is the center. Einstein is the one who actually said the problem showed that the problem is moot. I talked to you earlier this week about reference frames. In order for us to actually answer the question today, you need to have the absolute reference frame. You know exactly what I'm talking about. All of you must have experienced that very unsettling feeling when parked at traffic lights and suddenly somebody pulls up next to you and you feel like maybe the car's rolled backwards, and you put your foot in the brake if you're driving the car, or if you're a passenger, you go like this suddenly, you feel unsettled. Your world has been shaken because, remember, we have to have faith in order to live in this world, Christian faith that things work in a certain way. And so there, just like those pictures I showed you, you have something happening that is shaking your world, that's giving you a different perception. Your beliefs are not matching with what is happening. And you feel as if your car is rolling backwards, but actually it's just another car that's rolling really slowly next to you. Okay? And so Einstein was the one who showed that we need an absolute reference frame. If you're in the car and you're looking at the ground and that car pulls up next to you, you never have that thing happening to you. You never have that dissonance. You never get nervous because you see the ground's not moving. Everything makes sense within the worldview that you have. Everything makes sense. It's only when you're looking at the sky, say, and the car pulls up next to you, there's no reference frame for you. And you're discombobbled. So we don't actually know, as physicists, whether the Earth revolves around the Sun or whether the Sun revolves around the Earth. Theologically speaking, everything is obviously centered on the Earth, which is the center of the redemption of mankind. This is the place where God makes history. And so in this picture, right, so you know the philosophical situation. I can show my students this. And I'm not saying, right, what Carl Sagan would say or anything like that. The Earth is the third planet from the Sun in terms of lining them up. Now, what I study in particular is something called plasma. And plasma is not the stuff in your blood, which is fairly rare. Plasma is the most common state of matter in the universe. It's the fourth state of matter. There are three: solids, liquids, gases. The first state of matter is plasma. Plasma is relatively rare on Earth, but it's actually the most common state of matter that we've observed in the entire universe. 99.9% of the known universe is made of plasma. If you like, you can think of plasma as a hot ionized gas. Okay? So it's a hot ionized gas, and you've all seen plasma. For instance, in those neon tubes, flashing neon tubes, that's plasma inside those neon tubes. Sometimes on the edge of the flames of a bonfire, you can get plasma momentarily. The reason it's not so common on Earth is it gets destroyed. It changes its state of matter. Just like you've seen water change its state of matter, it can turn into gas or it can be frozen into a solid. You can have different states of matter. The plasma can change it into a gas very quickly when there's lots of gas around it. But the rest of the cosmos is full of plasma, and there's very little of the other states of matter to interfere with it and change it. The Sun is what is considered to be most important in space physics. It's responsible for most of the space weather. Most of the energy of the Sun comes towards the Earth as sunshine. Huge amount. 95% comes to the Earth in terms of sunshine. And all kinds of other colors that you're not able to see. The warmth that you feel from the Sun is infrared radiation from the Sun and ultraviolet and others that are doing just like the light in this room that I described. They're actually creating electric currents in your skin. And just as electric currents in a toaster, you know, you run an electric current through the toaster element, it gets hot. The photons, the electromagnetic waves are coming onto your skin, interacting with the electric and magnetic properties of your skin, and they're generating small-scale, short-lived electric currents and that warms up your skin. You feel warm. Other things are passing right through you. Other things are blowing holes through your body, damaging your DNA and such, coming from the sun. Your body is repairing all the time. It's being insulted all the time. We're not only covered in bacteria, but we've been smashed by all kinds of particles right now. Not even to think about the gamma rays, which each of you are blasting each other with. So 95% is what we are pretty well versed in. All the weather, there's tornadoes and things like that, have to do with that. The last 5% is what determines space weather. And you may say, well, that's not very much then, so the 95% is what we really are interested in. Yes and no. Yes and no. It depends where we are. Since we've put so many assets into space, and since we've become so dependent upon those assets, that 5% is very important to us today in the United States. It wouldn't be very important to somebody, you know, Aborigine in some dark jungle, let's say in Brazil, which has never met anybody else. Space weather would be nothing, total unknown, and there would be no effects whatsoever on their life. But for us, it's very important. Now, this is what the sun looks like in ultraviolet light. And ultraviolet light is like sunglasses. Remember, the sun is giving off light of all colors. We can only see. God has made this world in such a way that the peak of energy, the peak of the light energy, it goes like this. Actually, let's see if I can draw that. I won't draw it yet. The peak of the light energy goes like this for the frequencies. So there's light of all colors. The peak is just where we are able to see. Isn't that remarkable? Is that surprising? Not necessarily, actually. It seems as if God designed the sun for our eyes to see. The evolutionists would say over some long evolutionary process, that's just the way it happened. But that's not the case for other creatures on the planet. Bees and other insects, for instance, don't see what we see. Yeah, that's remarkable. When a bee flies up to a red, red rose, it might not be seeing a red, red rose. It sees a big sign that says, eat me, or something else, right? It could be striped. The bee sees something else. I think you can appreciate this concept in terms of in writing. You know that hidden writing? You've all probably done that with lemon water, and you write on the paper, right? That is kind of what it's like. There's light that we cannot see, but God has made other creatures who can see those particular colors of light. We see right at the peak where the best light is coming from, the brightest, most consistent light is coming from the sun. That's what we were able to see. This here is a picture of the sun taken in ultraviolet light. So if you were to look at the sun, perish the thought with naked eyes, Galileo did that and became blind, because you're not just getting white light that we see, but you're also getting less, you know, not the same amount of photons, but more energetic light from ultraviolet and others, which do damage your eyes. This is in ultraviolet light. So we put sunglasses on, essentially, and then we look at the sun, and that's what you can see. And you put different sunglasses on, and you can see all kinds of different things. Okay? So you can see all kinds of tremendous activity on the sun. This is what the sun looks like. Once upon a time, the people thought the sun was a perfect orb. That's why the Greeks actually had the Earth orbiting the sun. The heliocentric theory was not new. Galileo wasn't making some new idea. That had been around for thousands of years prior to him. The Greeks had said, this is perfect. People had worshipped the sun. We read about it in the Bible for millennia. And so that had to be the center. The Japanese still call their country the land of the rising sun, and people there go and worship the sun in the morning, some of the Japanese. It was perfect. However, in later years, Babylonians discovered that the sun has sunspots. You could see those in visible light. There's like pimples on the surface of the sun. And then if you look in ultraviolet light, this is what you see. And furthermore, we discovered then that the sun is rotating. Here is a video showing you the rotation of the sun. Notice the scale on the bottom? That's hours. So obviously it's rotating a lot slower than I'm running this video. And you can see this motion. Now, what's interesting is the size of the Earth would be, you know, it would fit, you could put 10 Earths in that little white spot over there. Those bright spots refer to massive explosions on the surface of the sun, massive explosions. Think of millions of atomic bombs going off every second. That's what's going on the surface of the sun. And the surface of the sun has a special name. It's called the photosphere. It's constantly bubbling. It's got a temperature of about 6,000 degrees. You've all touched about, well, maybe not all of you. Have any of you ever broken one of the banned light bulbs? You can break them. Those are safe. Don't break the new light bulbs because those are full of mercury, which is poisonous. You've broken one of the banned light, the incandescent light bulbs. No, not the long rods. The ones with the filament. That's the one the government has banned in order to save the planet, yeah? If you broke that light bulb, that filament right in the middle that's glowing white hot, it's glowing at it's about that temperature, 6,000 degrees. It's the temperature of the surface of the sun. Pretty cool. So why didn't you die when you broke it? Oh. Wasn't on. No, there's not a vacuum. They put so-called noble gases into the bulb. The reason they do that is because oxygen, which we all think is wonderful and really good because we need it to live. Actually, carbon dioxide is wonderful and really good. Plants need it to live. Oxygen is a poison. What happens when we breathe is the oxygen comes into our body, goes into our brain, and oxygen is like a garbage truck. It just latches onto everything. Oxygen wants to oxidize everything. It's greedy. It just goes like, it just wants to get its fingers into everything. Now, you see, you're not naive anymore, so when I say it gets its fingers in, you understand that I'm using a metaphor, right? Yeah. So the oxygen is trying to get its fingers into anything. So you breathe in, the oxygen goes into your brain and it takes out carbon, which is a process of our life, which is sitting in our brain, binds it to the oxygen, we breathe it out. Oxygen does the same thing to everything else. Oxygen is responsible for some of the damage to your skin. You read about that all the time, right? Eat your antioxidants. Eat your whatever, acai berries and all of that, because those are antioxidants. It just limits the ability of the oxygen in your body and in touching you all the time to cause decay. Well, if that oxygen were to touch that light bulb at 5,000 degrees, touch that filament, the filament would just decay very quickly because the oxygen would burrow into it and just break it up. We don't want that to happen. We want stable light bulbs. So they put noble gases in there, things that do not react well with anything else. So it's not a vacuum. The temperature of the sun, we understand, is actually even hotter inside. Now, how do we do that? I teach my students, yeah, the temperature can reach millions of degrees inside the sun. Has anybody ever put a thermometer in there? No. We use theory. We use explanations. And I have reasonable expectation that it is indeed millions of degrees. I would say I have a reasonable belief that that is the case. I may be wrong, but all the evidence that we have to date is that it's millions of degrees. And I won't go into exactly how we do it, but clearly it's not a direct measurement. It's not like you're seeing me now with a direct measurement. We have theory, we build on those ideas, and then extrapolate. It would be like covering an elephant with a sheet, and I've got all kinds of data, I can feel it, and I can see movement, and I say, okay, that's what I think is behind the sheet. I think the temperature is this much underneath the surface of the sun. Now, the sun goes through a cycle called the sunspot cycle, or the solar cycle. It's an average of 11-year cycle, although it can be highly variable. Sometimes the cycle dies down completely, it just vanishes. But typically it's an 11-year cycle. So I'm showing you a few years here, 5 years worth of the cycle, and you can see again in ultraviolet light, the surface of the sun. You can see the glow around the sun, so the ultraviolet light is extending out, and of course it's blowing in or flying in all directions towards us. 1996 through 2000, notice the activity on the surface of the sun, this, how explosive things appear as time goes by. 97, you start seeing massive explosions, more, 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 up to 2000, which was solar max, the last solar max. Very, very active. So we have solar minimum and solar maximum. During solar minimum, there's a lot less energy coming off the sun than during solar maximum. Active and quiet phases. And actually, we're supposed to have been in a maximum right now, 2015. But there's a lot of scientists, particularly in Russia and in other places in Europe, who are quite concerned because for the first time, in our living history, the sun is in incredibly low state. Here is the sunspot cycle showing you what happens with the solar cycle. This roughly 11-year cycle is fairly clear. You can see it over here and over here. From peak to peak or from trough to trough is roughly 11 years. But you can see big gaps right here around 1650 to 1750 or so. Even before 1650, rather low sunspot numbers. That's not because nobody was counting the sunspots at that time. It's just there were no sunspots. This was a really bad time for the pilgrims to try to come to New England because it turned out that this long period of low sunspot activity correlated with something called the Little Ice Age. The Vikings had moved to Greenland. The Vikings were frozen out of Greenland during this time. They died out during that time, during the Little Ice Age. Why do you think they called it Greenland? It was a green land, a beautiful place. Before 1600s, when the Vikings had come there, the earth had been warming for quite a long time. We had been coming out of an ice age and things had been pretty good. This year corresponds to what is called the Little Ice Age. Over here, this is the Little Ice Age. And ever since then, if you were to look at the what we call in physics the envelope function, actually in quantum mechanics you call this the envelope function, ever since then you could draw a line through that, maybe a little bit lower on the edge there, but that's close enough, and there's been an increase. The sunspot cycle has been going through its regular 11-year cycle, but generally getting higher and higher and higher. The peaks have been getting higher and higher and higher. That continued till around here. If you read newspaper reports, I talk about this in my book from the 1900s. The New York Times was fretting because they had found palm trees in Antarctica buried in the ice. Conclusion obviously was, wow, it was a lot warmer in the past because palm trees don't grow in the ice today at any rate. So they were saying, well, that's good news because it's been really cold here during this interval of time, really, really cold, so there's hope that things could warm up again for us. They were very concerned. During the 1950s, everything warmed up. We actually did have a warming period in the Earth up to about 1950. Then around this period of time, from about 1950 to mid-1970, there was a cooling trend, a global cooling trend. The United States Congress held hearings on global cooling because scientists were saying this is a very bad thing. We could be going into another ice age like this. The sunspot numbers are dropping down. We could be going into another ice age. And ice ages are bad because they cause hurricanes, tornadoes, flooding, droughts, you know, all the same things that we're told global warming causes. I'm serious. So that's what we were told. Then there was a warming period. A warming trend began from about 1976. That warming trend continued from 1976 to 1998. And you all know about the global warming that we've talked about. Right now, we're off the screen here. The sunspot cycle has been going desperately low. People are quite concerned, and many scientists are once again saying we might be going into an ice age, which is bad, because many, many people die. Many more people die. Remember the cost-benefit analysis? Would you rather have winter or would you rather have summer? More people die from cold than from heat. So cold is actually very bad. It also limits the growing season. So more warmth is better. It's good for biodiversity. It's no surprise that places near the equator where the temperatures are warmest all year round have the most biodiversity. Places like Antarctica have the least, which are colder. So cold is bad. Warm is good. Global warming would be good for our planet, but it seems from the data that we might be entering into a cool period. And even the scientists now associated with the IPCC say that the cooling we've had since 1998, we've had no global warming since 1998, and a slight cooling trend might continue to 2030, they're saying. Yet you hear the politicians saying that we've got to shut down all the coal-fired power plants in this country in order to save the planet, because coal-fired power plants breathe out carbon dioxide, which is causing catastrophic global warming. It's not rational. They're treating you as if you're stupid, or as if they just don't care. But this is what the sunspot cycle looks like. Another thing that's interesting to us are these so-called coronal mass ejections, which are massive bubbles of plasma that explodes from the surface of the sun. I'll show you about 1 month's worth. This is called a coronagraph. What we've done is we've occulted the sun, to occult the sun means just a cover. So there's light there that's in my face. I can occult it so I can see you. Richard Dawkins does this all the time. He goes like this to the sun of God. Oh, gone. Doesn't exist. See, I've occulted it. Now I can see you much better. And you've all done this as well. If somebody shines a flashlight in your face, you go like that, and then you can see around it. So the photosphere of the sun is this white surface, and the occult disk is what you see up to around there. So now let me show you this video, and you can see plasma blowing off the surface of the sun. See that huge explosion there? Ba-bam! There's another one. If an astronaut were in the way of some of these explosions, they would die quickly. What you see in the background is the star field, because of course you're observing the sun and everything's moving. But the stars are far away in the distance, so it looks like they're not moving. It's the fixed background. Isn't that cool? Who thought the sun was quiet? You see big holes here? These are what you call coronal holes. And other things can come shooting out of those. You can also see a certain shape as well to this. Let me show you that one more time so you can see the comet, which comes running across the background. You see a comet running across the background. This is taken with the Solar Heliospheric Observatory. It's a satellite which sits between the Earth and the Sun with these special sunglasses on its face. The Sun's shooting off more than 4 billion tons per second of matter. Okay? Huge amounts of matter. Now that's not going to push the Earth. It's not going to move us, because the Earth is 10 to the power of 24 kilograms. It's much more. It's much heavier. It's actually the plasma that interacts with our planet, which is what is interesting and dangerous. Now let's take a zoom in. We zoom in here. We look at a slightly different frequency. And you can see this bright spot over here. And we're going to see a coronal mass ejection developing in this bright spot, and then exploding. It's like a gigantic burp out into space. Blah. There it goes. Get ready? Bam. And what are all those little fuzzy mosquitoes? You know, when you look at the sun, actually, if you even look at one of these bright lights, do that, that's safer. Well, don't. I don't want you to be blinded just now. Do it later. You look at that, and then if you try to look at something else, you have that image on your retina, don't you? You just keep seeing it, and you've got to shake your head, and you wait, and eventually it goes away. What's happened is your optical system has been overwhelmed. The same happens with our optical system on the satellite. When you build the instrument, you build it within a certain range. You can see this much to this much. If more comes, it's like somebody throwing balls at you, right? You can catch one ball a minute, no problem, but if they start throwing 100 balls a minute, you lose control, and that's what's happening here. These little white mosquitoes that are happening is just the machine is overwhelmed. There is so much energy coming towards it that it is blasting its little eyes. Now, another thing that I want you to just notice on here are loop-like structures on this area. Loop-like structures around there. So let's play it again and take a look at that. You see loop-like structures developing? There's some over there as well. That gives us some idea about the solar magnetic field. The sun has a powerful magnetic field. You can't see the magnetic field. In fact, many physicists think magnetic fields are simply didactic devices. They're not real. Electric or magnetic fields are not real. It's a description of what we observe. You can see the loop because the way we understand it is charged particles, electrons and protons, move along those, and any accelerating charged particle gives off light. Matter, remember, is related to light. E equals mc squared. And so, girls, if any guy comes up and he says he's Superman, you've got to ask him to shake his hands really, really fast, because if he is Superman and he's got some charged particles between his finger, he can shake them fast enough that he should have light. He doesn't need to go anywhere with a flashlight. He can just go like this and walk along and he'll make light from the charged particles. You can see if he's telling the truth. Now, Earth has a magnetic field as well. It looks something like a bar magnet. It's not a bar magnet, again, just a simplified picture. It looks like this. And the northern hemisphere is actually in the south. So there's been hemispheric discrimination, which I'm opposed to. We've got to end hemispheric discrimination. The southern hemisphere on all the geographic maps is actually the northern geomagnetic pole. So Earth's magnetic field looks like that, and this is our shield, without which the solar wind, which is the wind that is blasting off the surface of the sun, would wipe off our atmosphere. Just as if you're feeling fairly warm and you put a fan in front of you and it blows towards you, you feel all that hot air which was just sitting there getting wiped off your face and you feel much better. That's what's happening. The Earth's magnetic field is protecting us from that constant blast of solar wind from the sun. Now, if you were out in space, you couldn't feel the solar wind. We call it the solar wind again metaphorically. It's not a wind. It's plasma moving at about 5,000 kilometers per second. So 3,500 miles per second is the speed at which the plasma is moving towards you. But at most there are only 10 particles in a cubic centimeter. A cubic centimeter is about that big. Take a cube about that big. There's only 10 particles in that. Compare this to, you know, 22 orders of magnitude times 10 times 10 times 10, 22 times at least. That's how many particles there are here, which you can feel as you move your hands through it. So space, relatively speaking, is a vacuum. But it's not empty. There's lots and lots of stuff in it, tons of stuff. But most important is the embedded magnetic field in the solar wind, because that comes and smashes into Earth's magnetic field. But thank the Lord that God in His providence gave us this magnetic field, and then He gave us the minds in order to study it so that we could see His providence and see how He made this to preserve life. So it's like a fast moving rock in a stream. So how do we study this? Basic, at the very basic level, we use equations like these. This is called the Lorentz force equation. These are vectors, and those of you who don't know what I'm talking about don't need to worry. This is supposed to refer to the electric field, E electric. B is the magnetic field. V is the velocity of this yellow particle that is coming along. And Q is the charge of that particle. So you see how complicated it would be to put male or female in. So we just prefer plus or minus. You know, minus 10 women, plus 10 men wouldn't be so helpful. We say plus or minus charge. So a charged particle comes in an electric or a magnetic field, and what we have observed is that it gets pushed around. Those were the actual physical observations. Somebody actually had a little piece of metal, they ran an electric current through it, and then they saw that bright things started developing here. Then they put magnetic and electric fields, and they saw that the bright spots changed direction. You could move where the bright spot happens, and that's exactly the principle that was behind the older TVs, which had a vacuum tube in them. You just shoot those charged particles, that's the way we understand it, through there, through an electric or magnetic field, and you can move them wherever you want. They hit the fluorescent screen, you increase the energy of them, and that changes the color on the fluorescent screen, and if you do it cleverly enough, you can make moving pictures, which your brain will perceive. You see the picture, you say, wow, there's somebody on the TV. Of course there's nobody on the TV. It's just the colors are forming that image, which you can understand. So here's what happens to a charged particle in this blue magnetic field. It actually gets turned around, so you can guide them. And so what we do as physicists, we model that. You'll get throw lots of charged particles into a mathematical model with weird magnetic fields, and you can cause particles to move wherever you want them to move. That's the principle behind a tokamak, which is a very big machine which has particles moving close, charged particles moving close to the speed of light, with incredibly high temperatures, higher than 5,000 degrees Kelvin, so hot that if they were to touch something, they would melt anything. Any bottle that we would make today couldn't hold them. So how could you possibly hold them? You use a magnetic bottle. You keep them in magnetic fields. If any of you... we can't do the microwave thing. Well, you can make a magnetic bottle. So it's a bottle that you couldn't see. So if you've seen some kind of... some person's idea of this on TV, you could see some glowing bubble of something, and it's confined, but you can't see what's holding it. That would be a magnetic field. We just shape the magnetic field so that the particles come and they try to bash into the magnetic field and they get turned around. We just keep turning them back into the bottle so they don't escape. Because once they escape, they'll touch something else and you will no longer have those charged particles. You'll have a different state of matter. Then we study this even further, and we can make massive models. That was just one charged particle, and I was talking about billions of tons of matter. So here we have a model showing you, the only thing that you need to really focus on is this area, showing you what happens when that magnetized solar wind comes towards the Earth and smashes into the Earth. So we have here in the center of the Earth, these colors refer to the number density. So how many particles? Think of a room. If somebody yells fire right now, there'll be a rush for the door, and the number density would be very high at the door and very low over here. Right? So if I were to plot a figure of density in this room, it would be red. That's the scale that I have over there. Red is high density. It would be red near the door and would start getting blue down here. Does that make sense? So that's what we're having over here. And so you can see high density up front. That kind of makes sense if you think of a rock going through water or a motorboat. You've got a lot of friction right there at that front of the boat, and then the friction sort of tails off. Lots of particles are smashing into it over there. It would be the same at the door, right? If somebody's standing outside the door, everybody keeps smashing past them. Lots of friction as you go out the door. So lots of reds there. But notice how Earth's magnetic field is deflecting that. So this white here is showing you the Earth's magnetic field. And it's changing as it's getting buffeted by the solar wind. But you can see that it's defending us, protecting life. Bam, that was a coronal mass ejection, which squashes our field, tries to get in, but our shield held. It's like the Klingons. You know, they shoot their proton torpedoes, shields up. It's exactly the same principle. Those shields have to be magnetic fields. So when they say full power to front shields, you're putting all your power into a big electric current in the front, which produces a magnetic field. And then those Klingon proton torpedoes come flying towards there, bam, and those shields just cause them, using that equation that I showed you in the previous slide, causes them to deflect. That's the idea. That's the principle. So what happens to the Earth when a coronal mass ejection actually comes smashing into the Earth? Artist's rendition. This is not real. But you have a coronal mass ejection coming off the surface of the Sun. Boom! Huge explosion. Plasma and strong magnetic fields rushing at 5 to 10,000, maybe more, kilometers each second hit the Earth, start peeling off Earth's magnetic field, breaking it, which gets pulled into the back like a rubber band. And at some point the tension gets too great, the band snaps, bam, and whips back towards the earth, and you get these beautiful northern lights as some of that plasma from the sun makes it into our atmosphere and smashes into the atmosphere. And we see beautiful colors. Have any of you seen northern lights? I would imagine in New Brunswick you have. They've been seen as far south as Texas. It's just, even if you live in New Brunswick, you're not looking up all the time. And so if you were in Texas, you'd have to be looking up at the right time and be in the right place. No clouds either, because these are occurring high above our heads. And it's caused by particles, this plasma, smashing into our atmosphere and destroying it in some ways. You get different colors. You can see reds and pinks and greens and blues and other colors which we can't see, but they're there. They're auroras. So here's another rendition of what that looks like. There's the Earth's magnetic field. And we've got a coronal mass ejection coming from the sun. That's what causes the space weather. People always say, oh, solar flares cause it. No, no. Solar flares are associated, but it's the coronal mass ejections. These are the particles now that have made it in. They've made it into our atmosphere. They're coming down into the atmosphere, and they're going to start smashing into our atmosphere where there's much more density. They're coming along, and they're going to start hitting into nitrogen and oxygen. Bam, that's an electron that hits an oxygen atom, and oxygen, when it gets hit, glows. In quantum mechanics language, what's happened is we've raised the oxygen atom to a higher energy state, which is unstable, and drops to a lower energy state, and in dropping so, it emits light of a particular color. The green is high energy electrons smashing into nitrogen, and blue is proton aurora, protons smashing into particles and gives off a certain color. How do we know this? Did anybody go into the atmosphere and measure it? No. We did an experiment in the lab. We created particles which are of the certain energy. We had sent balloons, we sent satellites, we shoot rockets through there, we measure the energy of the particles that are coming down. How do we do that? Just like the balls. You throw the balls at somebody and you feel how hard the ball hits you, and you've got a theory about how hard it hits you, you can figure out what its energy is. Right? That's the energy of the ball. So we figure out the energy of the particles that are coming down. We go into the lab, we create those particles. We break something and shoot it at something else. So we shoot those protons at different elements, nitrogen, see what happens. And we shoot it at oxygen, and we go, wow, lo and behold, we shoot an electron at an oxygen, you get exactly the same light as we see up there. So that's what we think is happening, because we see the electrons up there with those energies, and we know there's oxygen up there, and so that is what's happening. That's our explanation. You see these glorious auroras, and you see, if you were to go far to the North Pole, you wouldn't actually see auroras. Isn't that interesting? If I were to offer you a free trip to the North Pole, and I said, okay, we'll have to make a competition of it. You give me $100,000 if you see auroras, and if you don't, I give you $100,000 or something like that. The person who goes to the North Pole will be sorely disappointed, whereas somebody who is anywhere from New York up to New Brunswick, I guess not all the way, up to this latitude would be happy. They'd see auroras almost every night if they looked up, because that's the so-called auroral zone. That's where particles are smashing in all the time. And that heats our atmosphere, by the way. It makes it warm. It warms up the atmosphere a little bit. This is what auroras look like from space, if you were to look from the space shuttle. So you can see them like giant curtains. And if you've seen them live, it can look as slow-moving as clouds, or it can look like wild dancing screens. So we study space weather, which is a collection of magnetic and electric phenomena out in space. And the most prominent of these space weather effects are called space storms, which are kind of like hurricanes in space. And they occur just like I've shown you. When the coronal mass ejection hits the Earth, it causes disruptions. Electric and magnetic fields are produced when you shake Earth's magnetic field, and we observe the effects on Earth. All of these areas that I'm showing you astronauts, radio wave communication, airlines, passengers, and so on, are affected by it. The economic equivalent of a space storm can be the equivalent of a Hurricane Hugo. So tens of billions of dollars can be lost because of this. Our technology, our satellites, navigation, communications, power grids are all affected by space weather. Let's just take a look at some of them. The satellites, scientific and commercial satellites, are affected by space weather. This here shows you a map of our satellites in space in orbit around the Earth right now. There's other satellites which are, there's a lot more satellites than this. This is just low Earth orbit within a couple of hundred kilometers above us, our heads. These are all the satellites. And so you can see if those charged particles come flying in, just as it's trying to be depicted here, and smashes through the satellite. Remember you saw those little mosquitoes? The satellite can get blinded. The navigation system of the satellite can get messed up. A lot of them use guidance systems based on the Earth's magnetic field. But if Earth's magnetic field gets squashed suddenly, it's like the satellite is blinded. It doesn't know where it is. And it needs to keep flying. And if it flies in the wrong direction at such a low Earth orbit, you're in deep trouble. So there are issues like that. There are other electronics issues that you have to consider as well. Pipelines are affected because you get corrosion because of that universal solvent, oxygen. All right, you get increased electric currents which flow in these metal pipelines, and then when things heat up, the oxygen is more effective in oxidizing, and so you can get holes. And so people actually monitor these pipelines all the time for the space weather effects and try to mitigate that. Our electric power grids are incredibly fragile in the United States. They've not been upgraded for a very long time, and I expect we're going to have terrible trouble, not least because the government is shutting down many, many power plants. So you know, there is no replacement that they're planning, and they're shutting down coal, which produces 40%, was 50% 10 years ago, but now 40% of the country's energy. Meanwhile, China, with none of the environmental controls, builds and puts into commission 8 coal-fired power plants every month. So the Chinese are going to be building everything and selling it to us, because we can't build anything because we don't have the energy, we don't have the power to do it. So we'll buy it from them, and they don't have any of the emissions controls. I'm not sure if we're saving the planet or saving the Chinese. So there was a very large storm in March 1389 which knocked out the whole of the Hydro-Québec grid in Canada. There were 12 million customers throughout Canada and New York and a little bit further west as well, who had no power for about 12 hours. In a very bad winter, severe winter, you can imagine that would be particularly lethal. Radio communications are affected. You switch the radio on sometimes in winter, you can pick up other radio stations that you couldn't pick up in summer. It's because those particles coming from the sun and the radiation coming from the sun changes the ionosphere. We've got like a big mirror above us, and the radio waves that we shoot off, the radio stations shoot off, go and bounce off the mirror and come down, and that's how you hear it. You're hearing a reflection. It's not just like this from the radio station to you. It's not just, oh, there's the radio tower, so it's coming straight to me like that. If you're at distance, it's bouncing off the mirror called the ionosphere and coming down. But that ionosphere is changing all the time because of space weather. And that's affected severely by these things. And so the military in particular is very interested in this because their communications need to be consistent. Another effect is radiation, which I thought I'd bring in here because people have been conditioned in this country to be very fearful of radiation. The United States was supposed to be 80% nuclear by 2000, but due to the Three Mile Island nuclear, I won't call it a disaster, but nuclear problem. I can't call it a disaster because, like Michael Crichton, the famous author, said he wanted to write this novel about the nuclear disasters that have all happened. Nobody died. It's really hard, he said, to write a disaster novel when nobody died. It's probably the safest technology for energy generation that we have. Coal-fired energy kills about 50 people a year in the United States. Okay? You can't have something for nothing. This is the lesson that we've heard. Coal-fired power kills 50 people a year. That's a statistical number. We don't know who those people are. It's the same as people drinking Coca-Cola. You'd say Coca-Cola kills X number of people a year. Or eating organic yogurt kills a certain number of people every year. We can work the numbers out. Seriously. Coffee. Coffee contains over one... Organic coffee, you know, fair trade, whatever we want to call it, contains over 1,000 carcinogens. Would you drink benzene? Every time you have a cup of coffee, you're drinking benzene. Okay? So people with an agenda have made you fearful about all kinds of things. They would say, like, look at all the chemicals in this stuff. As if H2O is not a chemical. In fact, they did try to ban H2O in California once. There were politicians who were told there's a tasteless, odorless substance, dihydrogen oxide, which is poisonous and it's killing us. We've got to get it out. So somebody actually brought a bill until somebody pointed out that dihydrogen oxide is H2O. But it's a chemical, so people get freaked out. There is no cost-free technology. Okay? There is no cost-free technology. Those windmills that they are building, they say are going to save us, that's decimating the raptor, the eagle population, and other carnivorous birds, because they use those flight paths. It's destroying them. If an eagle lands on the roof of your house and you accidentally break or crack its egg, you go to jail for 10 years in the United States. The government will give you money to kill your own child. Applaud you. You go to jail for 10 years if you break an eagle egg. But the windmills that the government has approved is killing eagles, and that's somehow okay. Could you imagine if a coal-fired power plant killed an eagle? We've got to shut it down. We've got to shut it down. So this is just to say that everything that we do has costs and it has benefits. To cross this road to go and eat your food is a risky proposition. You have to decide whether you're going to take that risk. Do you know how many people die every year in this country from crossing streets? It's very dangerous. It's far more dangerous to drive a car than to be an astronaut in the International Space Station, statistically speaking. Okay? So you have to take those risks, and it costs us a certain amount to have the power. Of course, if we shut down all the coal-fired power plants, millions of people would die. And so that's the benefit analysis that we make. Insurance companies do it every day when they quote your insurance policies. So radiation is another risk that we have. Extreme radiation, if it did happen, if the Earth's magnetic field were blown away, or if astronauts were outside of Earth's magnetic shield going to Mars, let's say, they would be in danger of dying. For instance, if a solar proton event happened, one happened in August 1972, there was a space station up, but there were no astronauts on board at that time. Had they been on board, they would have been dead, because there was no way to bring them down. There was a solar flare that occurred, which had increased radiation. Astronauts would have first seen flashes of light in their eyes at around this time, 6:20 universal time, that's Greenwich time in England. By 1 o'clock they would have reached their maximum allowed dosage for their skin and their eyes. Their eyes would have been forming cataracts as a defense mechanism. They'd start getting blind. They'd be incapacitated. Later on in the day, they start getting flu-like symptoms. Flu feels like radiation poisoning. So that's what radiation poisoning feels like. The diarrhea, the nausea, etc. This lethargy, tiredness, that's radiation sickness feeling. By, you know, 5 o'clock, career radiation limit for skin would have exceeded. They would have been burned. Their skin would have been burned. If it's very extreme, basically your whole electrical system would shut down. You'd just collapse. And then... everything would shut down. So it is dangerous. Space is radioactive, highly radioactive. But this is an unusual event. This would happen once every 3 decades or so. That's what we've seen in our observations. And many people, some of you perhaps, would be willing to do it, to go into space. I mean, I think I'd be willing. You know, Virgin Galactic is selling seats to go into space for $250,000 a pop, and lots of people are signing up. When you compare the risks versus the benefits, some people would consider it worth it, just as some people would consider walking across the street worth it. what actually happens when these charged particles come through is they smash into your DNA like that, and they move things around, or they break strands, and your body fixes those up all the time. The oxygen in your body is doing the same thing, your body is fixing that up, and it turns out that a certain amount of insult is necessary. Sometimes, you know, if you keep a too clean environment, that's actually unhealthy for you. A certain amount of insult seems necessary to your body. Let's talk about lethal doses of radiation, just what do we mean by that. Don't worry about these numbers, we have units. Just think of a dental x-ray, okay? When you fly in an airplane across the continent, or to, let's say, Scotland or something like that, that's like getting two x-rays on average. So if somebody says, oh no, I'm not going to get x-rays, that's radiation. That's, well, you're flying, so you shouldn't be flying either. Actually, you shouldn't even be living in Colorado, because people in Colorado get 50 chest x-rays a year because they have high altitude. People in Greenville, South Carolina get a large number of chest x-rays as well because they're living near the mountains. Mountains are full of granite, which is a highly radioactive rock. We, in fact, could walk down the streets of Washington, D.C. with a Geiger counter and measure the radiation because there's so much granite in the buildings, radioactive buildings. Okay? So a chest x-ray is about 10, 20 dental x-rays. It's about 10 flights across the Atlantic, or from here to California. That's like a chest x-ray. On a bad day, you can get one, no problem. And if you're flying to Asia, you'll get many more. Many more, because you're flying across the poles, and remember, where do those particles from the sun come smashing in? Right there. So sometimes they will actually reroute flights if the radiation is too intense. And suddenly they say, well, your flight's going to take 3 hours longer, and you're going, ah, oh, that's why, because of space weather. Much higher levels will cause sterility in females. Men get sterile much later, but ladies, it's much more serious for you. So if you were wanting to be an astronaut, it would be a more difficult decision, because a man who became sterile could still father children. A woman who became sterile could not mother children. What is most dangerous? I think I'll skip for the sake of time this curve. There's just so much information that I won't mention. But what I'll draw your attention to this table at the bottom, just what is rather obvious to you. In terms of the damage threshold, the things that are most easily damaged with radiation, biological material is at the top of the picture. All right, you don't need very much. Whereas if you've got structural metals, you've got some kind of bionic arm, your bionic arm can take a hundred million times more damage before getting broken compared to a human body. And parts, different parts of the human body as well are more sensitive. Your eyes are most sensitive. Your blood forming organs like bone marrow and such is more sensitive than your finger. In fact, when I was an undergraduate, I did an honors degree in nuclear physics, and I was dealing with highly radioactive elements, and I was really curious what would happen if I held a highly radioactive element for a long enough time. I shielded my hand with lead so it wasn't going into my face. I just wanted to hold it and see if I'd feel some tingling or something. And I think I did feel tingling after an hour or so, but I think it was probably because I was, you know, you're cramping from sitting too long. The crazy scientist. In space, we measure this, okay, because it's of concern to astronauts and our satellites and these space stations and such. And this is an example of a dosimeter. It's a radiation device that people would wear in a nuclear power plant. Actually, nuclear power plants, I wouldn't have a problem living next door to a nuclear power plant. You can do the statistical calculation. It's safer to live next door to a nuclear power plant than to drive a Toyota Prius. It's safer to live next door to a nuclear power plant than to drink one cup of organic coffee every day. It's safer to live near a nuclear power plant than to eat organic yogurt. Okay? And I can prove that, you know, from the data. Statistically, it's really obvious. Actually, people live near the nuclear reactor every day. People who are in the military on nuclear submarines sleep next to the reactor. Now, is it safe? No, it's super dangerous. Just like fire is super dangerous, but you wouldn't jump into a fire. Some people have done this and suffered terribly, but if you respect the fire, you're okay. If you respect and understand to some degree the nuclear reactor, you can be okay. And so this is what happens. So people have these radioactive detectors. This is another one which measures radiation. This is my favorite one, Fred the Phantom Torso. Darth Fred, I guess we could call him, or something else, because he kind of looks a little bit like he's being in a mauling with a Jedi Knight. He's been decimated. He's covered with these dosimeters, and they put him in the space station to see where the radiation is maximum. You know, if you sit in this spot, where's the radiation maximum? And that tells the astronauts where to go and run and hide when something bad happens. There is no place to run and hide, but there's a few places that are not so bad. Actually, this is the Phantom Torso. I guess we could call this Darth Tyson Chicken and the Phantom Menace. Satellites are affected, as I mentioned. We've lost satellites because of space weather, because it heats the atmosphere. The atmosphere rises above the satellite and it slows it down. It's like you're walking and suddenly you catch your foot in something, you fall down. The same thing happens to the satellite. You slow down and you fall into the atmosphere and you can lose that. And there are other, this is the last thing I'll tell you about. We track debris as well in space. Debris can be, I thought I'd show you this just because it's really cool. Debris can be something as small as a fleck of paint. They used to paint spaceships. Then they discovered, you know what happens to your paint job in bright sunshine? It gets ruined, right? Imagine putting it out without the atmosphere, which filters over 99% of the ultraviolet radiation, which causes that, right? The oxygen plus the ultraviolet radiation ruins your paint job. Increase that. 99% gets filtered here on the surface of the planet, and we still suffer. Go out there in space, you get a tan in an instant, okay? Put your car in there and you will have flecks of paint getting ripped off. And they discovered this because flecks of paint would come off and then they're moving at 11 kilometers per second, right? Super, super fast. That's more than supersonic on Earth, and smashes into the windshield of your space shuttle. That's what happens from a fleck of paint on the windshield of the space shuttle. So just a fleck of paint that was burned off. So we've measured this. We have this other instrument, the LDAP instrument, which is an experiment. It's just sitting out there in space and it's measuring what happens. It's measuring radiation and seeing what hits it. And this is an example of things that happened, holes that were smashed into it from junk in space. It's not just human junk. There's stuff falling all the time. We have dust falling all the time, meteorites and such smashing into our atmosphere and doing this kind of thing. So an astronaut could get hit by a rock as well, just as well. These are all examples of things being penetrated. And we do this so that we can get an idea of how much stuff is out there, right? It's just like you can't see, but if you put your hand out and you measure for an hour, you can say how many times your hand was hit by a mosquito if you're driving in your car, like by a bug. And then you can say, well, I'm going to keep my hand inside when I'm driving on this particular road because there's just so much gunk out there in this time, but when I'm driving on this highway, that's pretty safe. I can do that. That's how they do that with this instrument. Move it out to different orbits, and you see that. So that's all I have. I remind you, the wind blows where it wills, and you hear the sound thereof, but canst not tell from where it came and where it goes. So is everyone that is born of the Spirit. We see this in space. You cannot see the plasma that is coming from the sun, but you can feel it. You can see the effects. This, of course, is speaking about God, the Holy Spirit. God is making a metaphor again that we can understand from our understanding. And we see these metaphors repeated throughout the creation, over and over again, which is no surprise because God has made this creation to reveal His glory, to teach us about His power. As Job says, who can understand the thunder of His power? Like we are seeing the merest whispers. God is just giving us enough that we can deal with, that we can handle. Because if He gave us too much more, I guess we would die. So thank you for your good attention.